While our able crew are trying to get the screen to work properly, so many of us did see the show, and it'll be kind of fun to do it differently and actually hear this discussion, then whoop, see the images. That will be, after all, you know, Pliny and the ekphrastic poets were able to write a great deal about stuff that nobody could see, but they were still interested in it. So let's get going. Titus Kaphar, in his two exhibitions at Jack Shaman Gallery, and of related interest, for those of us able to have seen it, his exhibition at the Studio Museum of Harlem. Martha Schwendener, we've seen two painters in Merlin James and Jack, Merlin James and Mama Anderson. We have relative debates about their investment, their qualities. Here we have, obviously, deep resonant historical, political interests and a use of painting at the service of that. We've got a big change of register, haven't we, in looking at such material? Mm-hmm. How do you cope with such a change? Do you have a different operating system when you would look at an artist like Titus Kaphar, or are you able just to look at it as painting and say this works, this doesn't work? Well, how do you go about it?
It's all the same. It's just here's some painting and here's some painting, is that all you need to know?
You to use that as a springboard to tell me something illuminating about.
You
always
ask that crazy question where I'm like, oh God. This is my third panel in 3 days. So for all of you who went to CAA too, bravo to all of us. Thank you. And that's also a way of putting off the inevitable, which I've been dreading since I saw this show. Not these shows.
This artist.
You know, I've seen his work for a long time, you know, when he was first in the residency program up there, and which I don't remember how long ago it was. And there's some things here that are great. The politics are obviously really vital, really important. Great ideas, a few even great art, not great. He's okay, you know, but it's just not for me. And the thing is that I'll admit but I've said it in print many times, I'm not a Kehinde Wiley fan. And there's a lot of Kehinde Wiley here. The person I do like sort of behind all that is Barclay Hendricks. Love his work. And so there, you can sort of see here, there are moments where I'm sort of okay with, you know, some of the Ferguson stuff where there's, you know, the sort of smearing on the canvas and everything. That one it was sort of okay, or the ones that have the drawing on the canvas and you see a face that sort of has three registers and it kind of goes down and you have a sort of, I guess kind of trying to you know, formally reenact disappearance or something of that nature. The ones though where he's cutting out and he's redoing the history paintings, that I just think is a disaster, you know, and we've just got great history painters like Carrie James Marshall and people like that. And so I think it's a really, you know, in the same way, you know, not to sort of shove him in the Kehinde Wiley thing, but there's a kind of cheapness to it that it's sort of like, it's a cheap trick sort of thing. And I think there were a lot of people in the gallery when I was there. I think it's, you know, what I usually call like the large print version of art. I think that it's got a very large print quality that is very readable. And I think it, you know, people can just not, you know, it's not like, gee, what is this work about? You know, it's so obvious. So I'm, you know, I was hoping not to have to say that, but, you know, and the Jerome project where he's dipped these paintings or applied tar to paintings, the materials are obviously extraordinarily loaded. this woman was talking about iconicity, you know, that he's redoing the icon, putting this figure of Jerome and these people who've been imprisoned or, sorry, I sort of forgot, were they imprisoned or, yeah. I think they were imprisoned, yeah. I wasn't sure if it was worse, if they'd been executed or something like that. There's an incredible pathos to it, you know, I mean, it's a terrible thing. And the tar, we know what that's referring to, but...
yeah, let me ask you then, Vincent, having taught Merlin James's critical theory to your incredulous class at SVA, would Titus Kaphar's shredding of a nicely prepared pastiche of an 18th or 19th century painting, or his cutting out of a silhouette and revealing another painting behind it, would that be an instance of what Merlin James would call literalism?
I'm not sure. I thought you were going to ask me if my students, how they would react to the subject matter of this work or the politics of it.
No, they're not the focus group that I refer to, I'm afraid, as the first port of call. No, I was interested in the problem of literalism, because it seems to me, I mean, with Marma Anderson and Merlin James, whatever your relative feelings about those two artists, they're both doing things... conceptually, and they're both doing things that could be classed as a gimmick with painting and support and questioning scale, and they both have chops as dispatchers of images in paint. Titus Kaphar obviously has a tremendous innate facility with drawing and in a kind of academic mode, and he deploys that to make these pastiches of paintings that then get chopped up. So I'm just thinking, I'm just probing whether that's an instance of a kind of literalism, of like a forced theatrical idea, which is just way bigger than the form that can contain it.
Well, see, I think this is another example of having to see something in person, because a lot of, you know, we have this mode that we're all in where probably our first impression of something is on a computer screen, and then hopefully we see it in person. And sometimes we don't. We just, you know, our only approach to it is by the screen. So, you know, if I had read about this work and seen it on the screen, I probably would have said that it was literalist and would have thought that its narrative, you know, greatly overpowered its means. However, that was not at all my experience in both galleries. I didn't go to the Studio Museum show, although I read about it, but I saw the two Jack Shainman shows. And I was really captivated by them, I have to say, on both levels, like the conceptual level and the physical level. Like, I really got into how he was, transgressing the picture plane, like how he, you know, he actually took one in strips and nailed them to the wall, like very carefully and precisely. And I was looking at the nails, there's long nails that, because the strips stuck out at a certain distance from the wall. That was one example, but each one had a very particular, you know, and then, as you said, you know, he's a master of an academic style, but he uses that, you know, in a very effective way, in a very different way. But someone you mentioned earlier, John Curran, I mean, he has this academic facility that he uses for his own ends. And I feel like we got video. Oh. Should we see it?
Yeah, let's let it run in the background and while we talk, I think. That's fantastic. Thank you very much, Isaac. Thank you, Diana. And. Let's actually, however, if you don't mind, just carry on with the discussion, and people can.
So the one with the Jerome project, which there's an example of that just passed in the video, the tactility of the tar is very palpable. In those pieces where the white, you know, well, I'm a little bit behind the video. The last ones with the strokes of white paint over the figures, kind of obliterating them. It's something that I always look at when I see strokes of paint. Like, is there a necessity to that stroke of paint? And oftentimes there's not. It's just decorative, or it's just filling in a space. But with his, I didn't feel that. I felt like each stroke had its own, reason for existing. So those are some of my responses to his work. Yes. I found it really pretty exciting.
Cool. Okay, Chris, for you, was the formal and the conceptual nicely aligned with this show and giving you a powerful resonant experience or not?
Yeah, no, I was just thinking for a second. I mean, it is difficult to talk about, out there level, just as looking at black artists as a black person and thinking about how that participation has manifested into various contemporary artists that were mentioned earlier. I mean, I think I talked about his work in relation to Barclay Hendrix to a friend. That was the first person I talked about. I think he is suffering from a kind of confusion that Wiley ran upon really quickly. And that is, you're in a certain kind of bind as a black figurative painter. The black community, from top to bottom, with some exceptions, expects self-representation in painting. And it's extremely valued for artists to be able to render drawing. I mean, to be able to draw and to be able to paint realistically is valued. The conceptual end of things, again, there's a kind of colloquialism that I think the art world doesn't always permit with certain black artists. I can't say the same for other ethnicities, but black American artists. And I think there's just, in a nutshell, I think these paintings kind of misfire on many levels. And at the same time, I have a huge amount of empathy for the effort because I understand the various populations of people in and outside of the art world that Titus Kaphar is talking to and coming from. And another full disclosure, he's from, according to his bio, he's from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan. They're very close towns. They have the same area code. And
so don't say a word against your fellow Missouri. Yeah.
Well, no, I wasn't going to say that, but just more to say that, again, the art, this is my point of view as a so-called critic, is that it's very difficult to divest the social from the art. And knowing where he comes from and seeing where, knowing the town that he comes from, the area he comes from, his weapon, which is intellect and art, to fight off certain demons. So I have a certain empathy for that. But I think that as art itself, it's not what I want. It's not exactly what I want.
Can I say something real quickly?
Please.
You're totally freaking me out because I'm from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I did not know that about him. Also, I didn't know you were from Grand Rapids.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We've been on things and argued together too. Yeah, yeah. So we have good arguing. But I thought what you said was so kind of perfect. I mean, about all these different things, about the kind of difficulty. I think you explained it much better than I could have. But as soon as I heard the Kalamazoo thing, I was like, because of course, the other famous Kalamazooan is Derek Jeter. So now I want to know more. I mean, Kalamazoo is a very particular place. So
well, West Michigan is, this is weird. I mean, in some ways, I don't know if anyone's trained against this, where I teach my students to think about the context of the artist, and you think about the time period that they were working in, you think about the small village that they come from. Whenever I teach Kant, which is rare because I'm not a Kantian theorist or by any stretch, but I always say to my students, remember, this is a guy who lived in a tiny little village, barely left it at all. He's extremely provincial. So when you think about his theories, you have to think about this, that as part of listening to, reading and listening to what he has to say. with Kafar, myself, and Nell Schwindener, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Southwest Michigan, was kind of infiltrated with Dutch Christian Reformed population, mostly of working class background, right after the Second World War. And most of the Dutch that moved there, in order to get jobs right away, joined the police force. And West Michigan is like basically centered between Detroit and Chicago. And at the time they arrived, had a kind of thriving black jazz scene, which was essentially attacked. And the police and various forces outside the police kind of baited the immigrant population to antagonize this community. Well, now if you're in Grand Rapids, Michigan, or Southwest Michigan, where Jeter is from, and Jeter's half black, half white, not that that matters, but when you're in that area, well, let me take a shortcut. I was born in 1970. In 1987 or 88, I had a girlfriend who was from Johannesburg, and we were just off again, on again. And through our conversations, we had the range of conversation. Oh, you're only dating me because I'm white, and no, that's not, you're cool, and blah, 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 back and forth. And then at one point, we were sitting around, and I said, what made your parents move from Johannesburg to Grand Rapids, Michigan in 1979? And she said, my stepfather said it reminded him the most of South Africa. Now think about that. That's where Titus Kafar is coming from. He's 37, 38 years old. So there's an effort to kind of use what he has in order to psychically survive. And, you know, in some ways it's very difficult to use art that way. There's only a few people that we know of that are very successful. I think Mike Kelly is somebody who's successful, but look how it ended for him. It's a very difficult thing to invest. It's almost hard. It's almost impossible to negotiate all of that into successful art making. It's very rare.
I'm surprised to have heard Hendrik's name and even Kehinde Wiley's name mentioned in relation to this material. The African American artist who comes straight to my mind is Whitfield Lovell, and that's because it seems to me that these are powerfully executed, but very pointed, kind of. I want to avoid the terms literal or theatrical, but it seems that they are deployed counters in an argument or in engendering a kind of set of reactions, rather than a form teased out for implications that might actually then even surprise the maker. And so, not that I'm a big fan of Hendrik's. I'm a very limited fan, but a fan of Wiley. But they are both working with materials which are so much about the style and, I mean, the stylishness of their subjects, or else they are working, manipulating materials that give back. Whereas I feel that both, I feel especially with Kafar, that the materials that is inert, is passive. It's he brings his skill to it. He executes it according to a plan. He does crafty, clever things with his materials. But there's nothing that the material is ever going to give back to him. I mean, I think just the tank. I mean, I did have with, as Vincent did, something of a, not quite a revelation, but I was so pleased to be seeing it in person. It was exponentially superior in person, but that's because those skills were that much more impressive. The way it's like a sardine tin opening to reveal one painting under the other. But it seemed like a sort of almost sophomoric or a populist idea of, you know, Jefferson and a black woman behind him, and okay, yeah, we may have got that already, but that's thank you for the reminder sort of thing. Not a startling, it's not exactly like Jasper Johns and opening a cupboard and not never having guessed that that would be in there, is it? So,
I think populist is a really good way to think about it.
Or democratic might be a nicer way of putting it.
I mean, among young black artists and writers, he is extremely popular. I mean, if for people that are 40 or 45 and under, you know, they're like, they love him. And part of it is, you know, I think it's the same problem that, you know, it's a problem with that any artist that is any particular type of person that's marginalized in any way, shape, or form, when they get a hold of an opportunity to discourse on that with backing, you know, everyone that empathizes or sympathizes with that effort roots them on, cheers them on. So he has tons of black people that love the fact that he's painting black people and putting them on a wall in Chelsea is a huge deal for a lot of people, just because it's so infrequent. And then also there's the artist Mike Cloud, who is an artist I'm friends with and adore, and as a person and as an artist. He talks often about the dilemma of black self-representation in art, that in some ways, we did a panel on Ken Johnson a couple years ago. Ken was actually there, and he and Mike got into an exchange. And he said, black self-representational art is like young white men at Yale painting abstraction. And it was an apt kind of comparison in the sense that the expectation for the young white male artist is a kind of intellectually, deeply culturally seated position on painting, and you just by virtue of the history that supports you participating, you're free from politics on some level. And so the idea is to go to the purest and ends of that art form and define the outer limits. Whereas for black people, and particularly young black men, you've been abandoned and you've been discounted. So when you get the opportunity to insert yourself into the history, you take that opportunity to do that, and that's the expectation based on your history.
Right, fascinating. I remember there was a time when Steve Locke, an artist, black artist living in Boston, told me his liberal professors were giving him grief as an undergraduate. They're saying, no, look, you're a black man, you need to address issues of color in your work. And he responded by exploring issues of pink and yellow in his work. But also actually bringing the gay issue.
Can I just say, though, also, I mean, marginal, yes, but the lineage here, Barclay Hendricks has an MFA from Yale, so does Kehinde Wiley, and so does Titus Kaphar. That's the elite painting, you know, thing. So what's that? Yes, I agree with you 100%. But that within the art world, he's coming up with something. It's not just an embrace, by black people or whatever. This is a very celebrated artist. And so he's hit the wall, you know, as far as I'm concerned. You know, he was very promising. I remember seeing the first, the studio museum when they have the three, the little show
with
three people.
I mean, the Studio Museum of Harlem is an institution devoted to black art. Jack Shaman Gallery, the majority of his stable are black artists from around the world, but that's his specialism. It's a niche industry almost. So, I don't know that that's. I don't think just saying that he's been to Yale takes him out of the margin.
Let's just say it's a little bit suspicious that we're to the three people. I wasn't like, let me think of Yale artists, and then there's a kind of lineage there in the same way that,
Well, Yale, a university founded by a slaver, maybe it's just good
I'm
karma.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the work itself. You know, I mean, these works are are, you know, formally, morphologically similar. Just a couple of other things I want to say. If it had been about Kalamazoo, I would be so on board. Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. I mean, we could go on about Kalamazoo.
Kalamazooians are more marginalized even than African Americans.
You know, it would be so great. But the other thing I just wanted to say real briefly, I'm almost out of time and we've got another show.
Okay, come on, go for it.
I forgot what it was.
Yeah, and you forgot what it was. Okay. During question times when we ask
our distinguished audience
to chip in, you can become an audience member and chip in. Your last point on Titus Kaphar.